This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. There is conflict in Congress on how to proceed, or whether to proceed at all, on a commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection, as well as on some of President Biden's key proposals related to infrastructure and other things. And the Republican Party, more than half of which, according to a new poll, still believe former President Trump won the 2020 election, dumps a member of a legacy family from leadership because she disagreed with Trump's lie. We spend the next hour talking about national politics with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Michael.
We also have with us today University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor Kim Conger. Kimberly, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you during our conversation today. What do you think of the job President Biden is doing? What do you think of the January 6th Insurrection Investigative Committee that could be formed in Congress? And what is your understanding or feelings about the federal government's handling of the pandemic at this late stage of it? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email your thoughts to talk at wvxu.org. Of course, those numbers and email addresses are something you want to keep in the back of your mind today as well as you consider the Political Junkie trivia question. Ken Rudin, what is this month's question?
Well, Michael, thank you for asking. John Warner, he's a former Republican senator from Virginia, lauded for his bipartisanship. And of course, everybody likes to talk about his marriage to Elizabeth Taylor. But more importantly than that, at least politically, he served 30 years. He served five terms in Congress, 30 years. So the trivia question is, since World War II, what Ohio lawmaker served in Congress longer?
Interesting. Longer than 30 years.
That's correct. Longer than John Warner.
A lawmaker from Ohio since World War II who has served longer than John Warner served in the U.S. Congress. If you know the answer, 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Ken, tell them what they'll win.
They win the most lovely political junkie button. And you know something, Michael, at some point, maybe coming close to Christmas, the prize is going to be a political junkie t-shirt or a political junkie pair of socks. They are gorgeous, but I'm just not willing to give them up every week. But Christmas time, stay tuned, okay?
Well, we'll stay tuned. I have no choice but to stay tuned, Ken, so I will be tuned in and I will look forward to seeing those. Hey, before we do jump into the politics though, let's hear some noise. Josh, can you play some noise for us? Oh, yeah, that is some noise. This noise you're hearing was produced by fame audio journalist Ken Rudin. Ken, tell us what we're hearing right there.
I walk out of my house every day, and that's the sound of cicadas. It sounds like a space invasion, like a futuristic science fiction space invasion, but that is exactly the sound, and it's not exaggerated. It's deafening, and it's kind of adorable in a strange way. I mean, you know, they come up every 17 years. You got to give them some attention and credit. But I think it's fascinating, and that's the sound you hear leaving your house, at least where I live in Maryland, once you get out of your house. It's incredible.
Well, certainly, and that's why I wanted to play it. You sent it to us earlier, I think, just for reference, and I heard it. I was like, we've got to get this in the show. We did our gardening show yesterday, and we talked a lot about cicadas. I know cicadas are on the minds of a lot of people in our region, and you live in Maryland, and I just wanted to share that because it shows how widespread these things are. And are you seeing a lot of them or just hearing them, Ken?
No, I'm seeing a lot of them. I'm seeing birds eat them in flight. I'm seeing dogs eat them. They're not supposed to eat them, but they do eat them. But birds, matter of fact, my bird feeder hasn't gone down. The supply has not gone down in the last couple of weeks because they are feeding themselves very, very thoroughly with all these cicadas that are available. It's just remarkable sound. It's an amazing sound. And does that lead into our Marjorie Taylor Greene segment? I'm not sure.
We will certainly get to the Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. I know there's a lot to discuss about her, and I think some of our listeners will want to weigh in on that as well. But thank you for sharing that audio. I talked about on the show yesterday, I live in downtown Covington, so I'm in the urban core. There's not a lot of legacy green space, so they don't come out, and I hadn't seen one, but I did end up seeing one yesterday evening on my stoop. So I guess they are starting.
I saw one straggler. So
I saw one straggler. I hope he was just, you know, exhausted after he came out of the ground to do what he had to do and was on his way.
Wait, Michael, he or she?
Oh, certainly he or she. He had the attitude of a young man. So I don't know, but I shouldn't presume its gender. All right, let's talk politics now. President Joe Biden has been in office, of course, since January, so that puts him at a little more than 4 months in the White House. And Ken, the president is enjoying high approval ratings when you consider the approval ratings of his immediate predecessors and how polarized the electorate seemed to be. So he's at an average of about 54% and has been since January, about 54% consistently across the board, month to month to month. And I'm just wondering, why is that?
Well, I think it's the things he is proposing, things like, for example, about climate and voting rights and gun safety. I think these are programs that even Republicans, not Republican lawmakers necessarily, but Republican voters support. They're not ideological issues. They're more common sense issues for most people. So I think what Biden is doing, he's definitely not veering off way to the left, as some progressives would like and some Republicans are claiming. He's really just doing things that are on people's minds. And the fact is that he also, you know, he passed a $2 trillion stimulus plan, which helped a lot of average Americans deal with the aftermath of the coronavirus. And he got the vaccine programs, yes, started by Donald Trump, but he implemented it under his watch. And more than 50% of the American people are vaccinated. And that is a very a popular thing and something very, very, you know, noteworthy and worthy of praise.
And so you mentioned the vaccines, and I know that because the vaccine rollout has been relatively successful, and a lot of the restrictions are now virtually gone in most corners of the country or scheduled to expire soon. But you do hear some criticism of President Biden from some on the right who say this is him taking credit for President Trump's work. And I'm wondering, Ken, if there's an argument that, sure, Operation Warp Speed started under the Trump administration, but President Trump was full of disinformation about COVID-19. And, you know, so are we to thank him for Operation Warp Speed in spite of all of the disinformation he deliberately spilled to Americans during the crisis?
No, I don't. I mean, I will say that this new information about where the origin of the virus came from and whether it actually came from a Wuhan lab, which is what Donald Trump had been saying from the beginning, and many people were dismissing as just fantasy, that may very well be the case. And I'll give Trump credit for that. But given the fact that for months and months and months, while tens of thousands that became hundreds of thousands of people died during the virus, and it was a virus that the president said, and President Trump said, that is no more than the flu, that it will go away, that it's a plot by the Democrats and the media to make me look bad, that taking hydrochloroxine or whatever it was makes more sense than wearing a mask. All those things that Donald Trump did to belittle the seriousness of the virus, with so many thousands and thousands of American lives were lost, and perhaps needlessly because many believe Trump, I cannot in my heart give him credit for anything that he did during this coronavirus. And I regret that I say that, but I feel strongly about it.
Let's bring in University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Kimberly Conger. Dr. Conger, I know you've done a lot of research about conservatives and Republicans, particularly Christian-oriented Republicans, as part of your academic work. Is there a connection to the religiosity of some of these voters and their allegiance to the idea that Donald Trump did, in fact, win last November's election, when we know that's not true? And there's recent polling that shows more than half of the Republican Party believes it to be.
Yeah, it's not clear that the actual religious beliefs are part of it, but it's certainly the case that where people are getting their news, where people are getting their information from, is likely to impact their opinions on the outcome of the election, and sort of Joe Biden's legitimacy as president. You know, and I think that what happens in a lot of those cases is that, you know, people who are active in their religious bodies are with those same people all the time. And I think that that's where you see a reinforcement of some of those messages. Although that's not always entirely the case, because we've seen some data recently about things like people who are willing to take the vaccine. And in fact, those people who are in church more regularly are actually more willing to take the vaccine than those who identify as evangelicals or who identify as religious, but are in church less often. So I think that there's definitely an impact there of religiosity, but it's a little bit more nuanced than just straight, you know, religious conservatives are pro-Trump or are anti-vaccine.
You can join our conversation and share your own perspective at 513-419-7100 or email your questions, comments, and thoughts to talk@wvxu.org. Ken, it does seem that the Republican Party today is still mostly married to the former president rather than any type of future up-and-coming politician. Would you agree with that assessment?
I do, and I think that's absolutely indicated by what the Republican House caucus did in getting Liz Cheney out of the leadership. She was number three in the House Republican leadership, and she was dismissed because she was criticizing Donald Trump for his lies and his insistence that he won the election, and the insistence that by many Republicans that the January 6th insurrection never happened. So you have, and it's so funny to see liberals and the media joining with Liz Cheney, because you know, there's no love lost between the media and the liberals and the Cheney family. But Liz Cheney was spot on when it came to what Trump was saying, what was wrong, what was dishonest, and what was absolute lies. And so it seems like the Republican Party, look, the person who replaced her in the leadership, Elise Stefanik from upstate New York, the Republican from upstate New York, she said, Donald Trump is the leader of our party. Like, I don't know if Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene speak for the majority of the Republicans, even though they're going on this America First tour. But they also say that we are Donald Trump Republicans and Donald Trump is the leader of the party. And in fairness, we'll see a lot of efforts by Donald Trump to decide what Republicans, which Republicans should win the primaries in 2022. So I would not dismiss his power in the Republican Party. I still think it's overwhelming. I still think he is the most popular Republican in the party. And all those Republicans who are saying, well, his influence is waning, we'll see about that. Of course, there is some investigation starting. There's a grand jury that's been assembled in New York. Things could change. But right now, this is Donald Trump's party.
Mm-hmm. And you're listening to the political junkie Ken Rudin on Cincinnati Edition. I'm Michael Monks. We're also joined today by University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Kim Conger. We're waiting on your calls at 513-419-7100 and your emails at talk@wvxu.org. And Dr. Conger, we saw across the country the handful of Republicans, for example, that voted to impeach the former president at the very end of his term because of what they viewed as his role in the January 6th insurrection, be censured by their state parties. We saw that even with Ohio Representative, Anthony Gonzalez. There's been just so much blowback against these individuals who voted against the president. What's happening with the Republican Party at this point?
You know, I think that it's an interesting kind of perspective on the party to see the state parties really, you know, reacting strongly against members of the party who seem to question whether Trump won the election. Those people who voted to impeach President Trump. I think what's going on there is that in many cases, the people in the states, right, parties are made up of activists, of the people who are the most interested and the most involved in politics in their local areas or in their states. And in fact, I think there's a relationship there between the reaction of members of Congress to claims of Trump's victory and what's going on in their home states, right? So we see people who are in districts that are more strongly Republican, who are afraid of being primaried by other Republicans who are more pro-Trump or perceived to be more pro-Trump. And so I think what's happening in many cases is that it is this sort of vocal minority, as it often is in political party politics, but this vocal minority of very strong, very consistent Trump supporters who are really driving what happens in the state parties and therefore driving sort of the relationship between members of Congress and their constituents back in the districts.
We got an email from Tony who says, wow, what a couple of days with cicadas on the gardening shows, then Ken Rudin and more cicadas. Always love these shows, even if we're going to have to discuss Marjorie Taylor Greene. We also got an email from Janelle in Hamilton who writes, no matter how much I try, I just can't wrap my head around this Marjorie Taylor Greene character. And let's go to the phones where we find Elaine. Hi, Elaine. What's your question or comment?
Oh, I have a comment, and I just wanted to agree with Ken that it appears that the Republicans in Congress only want legislation that will help make it appear that the Biden administration is failing, like as far as the infrastructure. They want to make it strictly for infrastructure and not bring help to the working class Americans. And I agree with Ken also that it's an illustration of Joe Biden's executive prowess that he got the distribution of the vaccine, which was critical. The creation of the vaccine was done under the Trump administration, as a number of people said on Twitter. However, that was scientists, not the Trump administration. The distribution, the tricky part, and shows the ability of Joe Biden as an executive is under his administration.
Elaine, thank you so much for listening and taking the time to call in and share your thoughts with us. You can also join us at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Ken, let's go back to the trivia question briefly, because I think we've got some people who want to try to answer it. What is it?
Well, the question is, I thought of this question after following the death of John Warner, who spent 30 years in the Senate representing the state of Virginia. And I thought I would ask, since World War II, what Ohio lawmaker served in Congress longer than John Warner?
All right, let's see who might have an answer for us. We go to the phone lines now where we find John. Hi, John. Do you have an answer to the trivia question?
Hello, guys. I think I might. Is it Marcy Kapoor?
Ken?
I'm sorry, I missed what. Did she say? Well, he meant Marcy Kaptur,
yes,
of Toledo,
right?
And that is the correct answer. She was elected to Congress in 1982, so she's basically been in Congress 38 years. I think she's the second longest serving woman in Senate in congressional history after Barbara Mikulski of Maryland. But Marcy Kaptur of Toledo is the correct answer.
How about that, John? Congratulations. I'm going to place you on hold, and our producer, Selena, will get your information, and we will send off one of those coveted political junkie buttons. Thanks for playing the game today. Ken, we got it right off the bat this time. So.
We did. Well, I will say, though, in one more year or two more years, Sherrod Brown, who was first elected to the House in 92 and then came to the Senate in 2006, Sherrod Brown will also surpass John Warner's record in a year or two, assuming he gets reelected in 2024.
Well, we will have more to talk about coming up. We will continue with the Political Junkie and your calls and emails. No more cicadas today, though, I don't think. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our Hour of National Politics featuring the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Also with us today is University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Kim Conger. Dr. Conger, thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
Join our conversation, 513-419-7100, or if you're hiding in the office somewhere again, you can email us too, very quietly, to talk at wvxu.org. I want to talk about a significant piece of, I shouldn't say legislation necessarily, but a proposal that's going through Congress that will need their approval. And it relates to the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And I recall in the hours and the days that immediately followed, these scenes of numerous hundreds of people flooding into the doors of the seat of government, there was bipartisan concern about what had been witnessed. And in the months since, Republican opposition to approving a 9/11 style commission to investigate what happened has only mounted. In fact, Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican, said that it was largely peaceful. Ken, what has happened in the months since January 6th that Republicans, for the most part, viewpoint on it has evolved?
Well, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House leader, among many people, went to the House floor and said Donald Trump bears responsibility, major responsibility for what happened. But basically, on sober second thought, Republicans are seeing that any kind of commission that talks about what happened on January 6th and Donald Trump's role in it, which of course a commission would come up with, it would be bad news for the Republicans, especially in the 2022 election and midterm elections. I know that everything is about upcoming elections, and that's always been the case. But this is especially true in 2022, when the Senate, as you know, is 50-50. The Democrats only have about a 5 or 6 House seat lead in the House. And so Republicans feel that this would be used by the media and the Democrats to portray the Republicans and President Trump in a bad light. And that could only hurt the GOP in the midterm elections.
Dr. Conger, your thoughts on how this feeling about what happened on January 6th evolved over the past several months?
Well, I think with any kind of, event or well-publicized situation, memories fade, right? And I think that what's happening is exactly what Ken has been saying. It's not necessarily that they have changed their minds, those members of Congress who were there and witnessed the insurrection. But I think they recognize that it is a political liability for them and for the Republican Party brand at this point. To bring up any of the kinds of issues that would surely come up about to what degree the president was involved, who knew what, when, and questions about the National Guard and all sorts of things like that. I think they see that as all downside for them, and that's why they've sort of tried to walk that back.
Ken, you mentioned Kevin McCarthy, who had some harsh remarks about the president's role in the insurrection shortly after it happened. He has since reversed course mostly. Senator McConnell has walked a delicate line on January 6th. He did talk about the president bearing responsibility for that, but he doesn't appear to be in favor in something like this either, in spite of the fact that President Trump is very openly not a fan of Senator McConnell anymore. Can you talk a little bit about how you see Senator McConnell's role in this discussion, in this evaluation of what many view as a significant piece of American history now?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, McConnell, like Kevin McCarthy, like many Republicans, did go to the floor and basically say that Donald Trump bears a strong responsibility for what happened on the 6th. But again, Republicans are so afraid of this being a commission that could be beneficial for the Democrats. And this goes back to the big fight over whether to end the filibuster, which Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer have been so wary about pursuing, while so many progressives saying, look, if we're going to get gun safety legislation, if we're going to get police reforms, if we're going to get immigration, the voting rights bill, which we promised after John Lewis's death, if we're going to get this to happen, the only way to do it is to end the filibuster or reform the filibuster. The problem for the Democrats in the 50-50 Senate is that they don't even have 50 senators backing them. Both Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, Democratic senators from West Virginia and Arizona, are against changing the filibuster rules. And so that kind of handcuffs both Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer in getting things like this commission passed, because the American people are clearly for it. Republican voters are clearly for it. But as Dr. Congar said just a second ago, that, Republicans know that this could bite them in the 2022 elections. And so why pursue this? So Susan Collins, among other Republicans, are trying to come up with some kind of a compromise. She said, well, maybe we should make all the staff hires subject to agreements between the Democratic chair and the Republican vice chair. But right now, only two Republicans that I could think of, Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, maybe Bill Cassidy, maybe Susan Collins, will agree with this commission. But that's short of the 10, far short of the 10 that would overturn a filibuster.
You just mentioned Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, also a Republican, and people will probably remember him as the 2012 Republican nominee for president. So less than a decade ago, he was the banner carrier of the Republican Party. Here's a quote from him from this week. Quote, I think the perception is on the part of the public that the January 6th commission just trying to get to the truth of what happened, and that Republicans would be seen as not wanting to let the truth come out. I don't believe that's what the motivation is, but I think that's the perception. So Mitt Romney sees some potential political vulnerability if Republicans do not go along with moving forward on a January 6th commission. Dr. Conyer, a couple of things here. One, does Mitt Romney potentially have a point in that respect? And to continue our conversation about the evolution of the Republican Party, we've talked about Liz Cheney, a legacy Republican, and now Mitt Romney, who find themselves on the outside of the mainstream of that party.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to compare the Republican Party now to the one of 10 years ago. And the one from 10 years ago is basically gone. So, but I think that Mitt Romney has a point in in his comments about saying that Republicans will be seen as not wanting the truth to get out. But here's the thing, structurally speaking, in terms of what's happening in the Senate and in terms of the way districts have been drawn for the House, the Republicans have an advantage, right? So the Democrats don't just need to win. They need to win big in a lot of weird places for them to actually continue to have significant control over the House and the Senate. And so what that means is that the penalty Republicans might see for not obviously being or not being part of a attempt to seek the truth, it actually is pretty muted in those kinds of electoral terms. They're going to pay less of a price because they're structurally favored in the way the system is currently set up.
Let's talk about go ahead, Ken, please.
Just to add something. I'm sorry, just quickly to add something to what Kimberly just said. And given the fact that the new lines, the congressional lines, because of redistricting, favors Republicans in states like Florida, Texas, and elsewhere, and hurts Democrats in the Midwest and the East, Republicans are likely to pick up seats because of redistricting, and that's going to help them as well in 2022.
Well, let's talk about a member of Congress that appears to be more representative of the new Republican Party, and that is Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I know we've gotten some emails about her already. She does draw a lot of attention on social media. But Ken, is this just a case of someone who says outlandish things and then draws a lot of attention, and people who participate in the social media all day long start talking about her? Or is she the future of the Republican Party?
Honestly, I don't think she's the future of the Republican Party. I really don't. I think some of the things she said about the California wildfires were started by lasers controlled by the Rothschild family. I mean, it just the insanity. And she compared that people who have to wear a vaccinated a thing when they go to a store is comparable to what the Nazis made the Jews wear with the yellow star. I mean, that's just insanity, and it's reprehensible. And you know, Kevin McCarthy could, you know, complain all he wants up and down. I mean, they basically created these Marjorie Taylor Greens and Matt Gaetzes and other less than sane members of Congress. But it's like saying, I think in fairness, it's like saying that Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota, when she did all those anti-Semitic tropes and those dog whistles about Jews and Israel and things like that, that she represents the Democratic Party, which Republicans are trying to say. But the fact is that we do see a few more Republicans than ever before backing QAnon crazy theories. The Republicans feel more threatened by a Liz Cheney than they do by a Marjorie Taylor Greene. And that is unnerving, to say the least. There was talk about censure that could happen. You know, they thought they were punishing her by stripping her of committee assignments. That's the best thing that ever happened to her. It frees her from any responsibility other than going on around the country saying these outlandish things. So I don't know if she's if she represents the Republican Party. She could be the future of the Republican Party. I think the 2022 midterms are going to be very consequential when it comes to deciding what's the future of the party.
Let's get to some emails from our listeners. Mark writes in, any political party will do anything, both legal and illegal, to win, to hold power. The GOP believes Trump will help them win, so they rationalize their relationship with him. When he is no longer helpful to their goal of achieving power, they will move on. Also, an email from Donald about the origin versus spread of coronavirus. He says, there is much commentary about the origin of the coronavirus responsible for the COVID-19 epidemic. Did it originate in the Wuhan lab? Did it originate from bats? Did it originate in the wet market in Wuhan? In my mind, that question is really not important. The important question is, why did the Chinese government allow it to spread worldwide? There are some political implications to looking in to the origins of COVID-19, and it appears that there's some backpatting among those who believed it was a lab leak very early, and then there are some questions about, you know, is that true now? Do we know more now than we did a year ago? And Dr. Conyer, do you see any potential political benefit for one side or the other based on what we might learn about the origins of COVID-19?
Well, first, let me say that I'm not sure we're going to find out anything more than we already know. And in fact, we don't have a ton of new information. We have, several weeks ago, a group of scientists saying, you know, people, I believe it was in the journal Science, saying we ought to take another closer look at this. But I think the reality is that the Chinese government is never going to allow any kind of investigation into this in a way that will actually satisfy one version or the other. I don't know that there's it's kind of hard to say what the political angle is on this. I mean, initially, I think a lot of people were opposed to the idea of a lab leak simply because it was held up as an example of Chinese malfeasance by the Trump administration and other spokespeople for the former president. And so the whole idea of that was not taken seriously by many people, just simply because they were held up by Trump. On the other hand, I don't know that whether it was a jump from animals or a lab leak makes any real difference right now in terms of public policy, in terms of vaccinations and things like that. But it does have some pretty significant implications for future relationships with China, not just for the U.S., but for other countries as well. And I think that's the piece of it that makes this a really complicated kind of question, because it's unclear that we're ever going to be able to get information that will allow us to say for sure one way or the other what happened.
Ken, your thoughts on that, because we do see how political COVID-19 was in this country, as it was in other countries. And we've seen these recent developments about the possible origins of COVID-19 lead to further criticism from Republican lawmakers, in particular of Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has long been the face of the government's response to COVID-19. What are the political implications?
Well, first, let me just say I agree with every word that Professor Conger just said. I mean, word for word, I was sitting here. I don't know if you could see me, but I was sitting here nodding, and it wasn't because of cicadas. I was just agreeing with everything she said. But I mean, look, ultimately, it's true. It doesn't matter where it came from. But of course, there is I told you so kind of element that could come from the Republican Party. But I think that would be a mistake from Trump supporters, I should say. But I think that was a mistake given the fact that he diminished and dismissed so much of the concerns about the virus throughout the god-awful year of 2020. But the fact is that nearly 3.5 million people have died worldwide from this. Nearly 600,000 Americans have died. And I think that given the fact that the vaccine rate in this country under President Biden has proven to be such a success, I think I thought it was horrific and ugly. The fact that the issue about masks and the vaccines became political issues. I would love to leave the politics behind, but just for one more thing about Dr. Fauci, he did say that it's worth investigating. He said that, you know, for the longest time we all agreed about what the World Health Organization had to say, but then when we saw that it was a lot of the report was written by Chinese doctors. I think, look, Biden said, look, I'm going to give U.S. intelligence 90 days to come to the answer. It's always important to find out what really happens in things that affect so many millions of people. Politically, I'm not sure it should be or will be much of a political issue.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our hour of national politics with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, also a cicada hunter. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Kimberly Conger. Dr. Conger, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Ken, President Biden is to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin coming up in mid-June. This is probably rather significant considering the relationship between President Trump and President Putin and all of the controversies surrounding Russia and the previous administration. What's at stake here for President Biden?
Well, certainly it's to, I think, reestablish the role of the United States in world affairs, which I think took a big hit during the 4 years under President Trump. And the fact that President Trump at one point, trying to remember when this exactly was, but it seemed like at a press conference, Trump seemed to indicate that he trusted President Putin more than he did U.S. intelligence agencies. So those days are gone, fortunately. But there are a lot of things at stake. And just the latest thing, the dictator of Belarus who forced down that airliner to take off a dissident, and that action was backed by Putin. I mean, in many ways, you kind of think that why do you elevate Putin to a summit conference when he's violating so many norms around the world? But there's so many things about cyber hacking and all the things that he's being accused of doing to the United States. I just kind of think that even if nothing gets resolved, the president is going to make the point that these things are unacceptable, and whether there are further sanctions, I don't know, but it'll be a different tone than there was between Trump and his buddy Vladimir Putin.
We got an email from Lori that says it's worth noting that local Northern Kentucky Congressperson Thomas Massey is wholeheartedly supported and joined forces with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Hitching his wagon to her dangerous and irresponsible statements and actions should worry all, including myself, who are represented by his voice in our government. He seems gleeful at the idea of garnering some of her notoriety and disruptive reputation. I should note that Congressman Massey's Twitter feed right now, the top tweet, is a retweet of Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene that says it's past time to hashtag fire Fauci. And Ken, I know you remember Thomas Massey from when Donald Trump lost it on the Republican congressman from our region here on the Kentucky side of the river because he opposed the original COVID relief bill and called him a third-rate congressman. But this is demonstrative that people seem to be coming home regardless of what President Trump says about them.
Well, Massey is a true believer, and he is a part of this group. As I mentioned, Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Jim Jordan of Ohio, the guy who can't find his suit jacket when he's at committee meetings. But the fact is that some of the language, look, you know, I remember way back, you know, right wingers, John Birch Society members, when they were members of Congress in the 1960s. But this has gone a little further when just flip comments about the Holocaust and Marjorie Taylor Greene at one point liked a comment on her page that Nancy Pelosi should get a bullet to the back of her head, and she liked it. Now she since deleted it. But she did say the things like that. So it's gone beyond what we've ever witnessed before. But it's not up to the Democrats. It's up to the Republicans to be as angry as possible. And maybe, I think only 5 members of Congress have been censured since in the past century. I'm not sure, but a censure at the minimum seems to be the likely thing. You can't kick her out of Congress. I don't know why you can't, but I mean, we've had demagogues and vile hate people filled with hate in Congress, and I would think it's up to the voters in her district in northern Georgia to get rid of her if they want to get rid of her. But that's what they did with Steve King in Iowa. He was saying some terrible things about race and immigrants, and the Republican voters kicked them out in the primary. It's up to the voters to do it, but maybe as a minimum, a censure is necessary.
Let's turn back to University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Kimberly Conger. I want to ask you about the infrastructure bill, but specifically how it's sold to states like Ohio. Obviously, there are negotiations between the White House, Democrats, and Republicans. President Biden has an ambitious plan for the nation's ailing infrastructure. Republicans want to scale that back a little bit, and I think some members of the Democratic Party want to see more specific proposals in other areas that aren't funded to their liking. When you think about a state like Ohio, Dr. Conger, and how it's trended towards the Republican Party in recent presidential election cycles, how is a piece of legislation like this sold to majority voters here in the Buckeye State by someone like Joe Biden?
Well, I think that it's not necessarily sold to the voters. It's sold to those members of Congress who can take these projects, right? Because that's what an infrastructure bill is. It's a series of projects in many cases. And that's why it's so attractive, both in terms of national politics, but also in terms of state and local politics, right? There are tangible impacts of these kinds of bills that can be demonstrated to voters. And so I think in many cases, what's going to really need to happen is that President Biden is going to need to sell it, yes, to Ohio voters as something that is useful, but more importantly, to those people who are in power in both in Congress, but even state and even, you know, county and local officials who can hold up, projects and improvements in roads and bridges and all sorts of things like that to say, hey, look, this is really going to help you. It's not just about, like, in general, this program to help people all over the country, but in specifically, this is how it's going to help you.
Ken, Ohio is set to lose one of its congressional seats. So the congressional delegation is dominated by Republicans right now. Is there an opportunity here for Republicans to work with the president, or do they see that as potentially challenging to what their district might even look like? Are they so focused on the next election that the state's infrastructure that could be boosted by these federal dollars isn't really relevant?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where you're going with the question, but I do know that...
I guess I'm asking. Well, let me just try to reframe that if I was a little clumsy with the way that I asked it. So Ohio's losing a congressional seat. We know that because of the census that's come out, and right. Redistricting will start. And so, I mean, you could see a scenario where incumbents are against each other. And so is there more benefit to bringing dollars into the district and fixing ailing infrastructure, or is there more benefit to fighting the president on it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one would think that, look, I, as you have, I've been on that bridge connecting Cincinnati to Kentucky multiple times, and I do say a prayer every time I go over that bridge. I mean, my goodness, it looks like it's going to go any second. So one would think that bridges, roads, and tunnels are not Democratic or Republican issues. They are what common sense issues, but, you know, I think Republicans love to do as much fighting as you can. You don't want to give Biden and the Democrats any credit. And it seems like every time there's a negotiation about infrastructure, the Republicans are offering less and less money for it. But it almost feels like the first of all, regarding the census, Republicans, Ohio has a nonpartisan commission, I believe, that determines what districts are going to be rewritten or whatever. But I was wondering, with, you know, with Tim Ryan leaving the House to run for the Senate, for the open Senate seat, maybe they will solve everything by just eliminating Tim Ryan's district and solving it that way. But I kind of think that the Republicans are going to try to do everything they can to run out the clock, because, as we said earlier, with new redistricting, with the likelihood of more Republicans coming to Congress because of redistricting and gerrymandering, that all the things that Joe Biden would love to have take place, the climate bill, the voting rights bill, gun safety, police reforms, immigration, if you run out the clock, maybe that's the way you handle nominal Democratic control of Congress.
Well, let's finish up with a conversation about Ohio further. There obviously is an election next year, and there's already movement afoot for what will be an open U.S. Senate seat as Rob Portman retires. He is a Republican. There's a Republican primary already developing, and Congressman Tim Ryan is exploring that on the Democratic side. I'm wondering, Dr. Conger, what do you think about how the federal races will shape up in Ohio? Will there be a Republican vision for the future as part of their candidacies, or is there going to be some sort of relitigation of the 2020 campaign?
That's a really good question. It's almost hard to sort of see how it's going to shake out at this point, because there are just so many Republicans who are, you know, either in the exploratory stages or who have expressed, you know, some interest in the job. Senate seats are kind of weird. In a lot of states, they have situations like we do here in Ohio, with one very progressive Democrat and one, you know, a Republican, either fairly conservative or sort of movement conservative. So it's a little bit hard to see how that will work. I think it will depend a lot on who the candidates are. I think there are some Republican candidates who are primed to relitigate 2020. But I think that it will also depend on what the Democrats decide to do, whether to go with Tim Ryan or somebody like Amy Acton, who is seen as sort of a newer version of Democrats for the state of Ohio.
Josh, do we have that cicada noise still handy? I'm wondering if we could possibly just bring that up one last time as we start to say goodbye to these guests who were so enlightening to us today. Ah, the sweet sound of cicadas in the spring. From Ken Rudin's massive backyard at his Maryland estate. The political junkie, Ken Rudin, thank you for being with us again today. We missed you last month. Glad you're feeling better. And good to have you back. We'll talk again next month for sure. And Dr. Kimberly Conger, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati. Thanks to both of you for a fun hour.
Michael, I'll see you in 17 years.
Thanks so much.
All right. Next time you emerge, we'll be together. I'll look forward to that. Don't forget, we got a Cicada podcast at WVXU.org. Brood 10, the Cicada podcast, featuring cicada expert Dr. Gene Kritzky and our very own Corey Sharber. You can stream and download that wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer, Selena Reeder, assistant producer, Nick Swartzel, technical director, Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.